Failsafe, guidance for resilient cloud architectures, developed by Microsoft Services and the Azure Customer Advisory Team.
All right, let's go ahead and get started with a little discussion on Azure platform and capabilities. So, a couple things we're going to talk about in the next hour or so. So when I first started putting this stuff together on kind of its first generation about a year ago, I realized we talk a lot about Azure as a collection of parts, but it's not. You need to think of it as a platform that you can then compose together in order to build things. Looking at each piece individually, you only see one piece of the elephant, and that tends not to be the best approach for understanding how to get the most out of the pieces you're working with. So we're going to walk through all of the core pieces of the platform, compute, network, and storage, talk about the scalability and availability targets for each, as well as the approaches for getting more of these individualized scale units together, whether it's more VMs, whether it's more services, or whether it's more data centers. And the key thing, the foundation for figuring out how to scale systems, figure out how to make them more available, figure out how to get insight into what they're doing, is to know the Lego blocks that we're working with. The second piece, which will probably only be about a quarter of the time, will be to dive into what are the canonical patterns for communicating between services. And I naively thought a couple weeks ago that, hey, this stuff's well documented, it's out there, it's easy to pick up. And then I'm looking at some interesting customer code, and I'm going, wait a minute, we've never documented this pattern. We've never gone through all the details of what's required to expose a web service. I know, it sounds crazy, but I couldn't find the document that actually walked you through, this is the pattern, these are the considerations, here are the tweaks you need to think about, and here are the trade-offs you'll be making. So we'll cover a little bit of the basic patterns. Some of it may be old hat, but with the introduction of .NET 4.5, and finally, for the first time in 11 years, which is how long I've been using .NET, we can actually do asynchronous code easily. I found anybody in the room used Node.js. Couple hands, you guys are cool. So Node.js is getting a lot of popularity out in the web community. It's getting a lot of traction. It's very simple, it's very straightforward, and it's also blazingly fast. And it's purely asynchronous. You cannot write synchronous blocking code in Node.js. I'm going to keep coming back to that whole asynchronicity pattern. I think you guys heard a lot about that yesterday, asynchronous composition between services. I'm going to hammer on that, both in terms of, hey, it's actually easy for the first time, and also in terms of how badly synchronous communication between components in your system will drop your site to its knees. Whether it's this web service, whether it's an all-up application, synchronous communication is not your friend. All right, so kind of key things. Azure services are all about scale units. It's a very abstract term. We'll make it a little bit more concrete and talk about some common scale units and how we stack them together, and then go into the patterns of how we stack them together, both to get more scale as well as to get more availability. Okay, agenda. The stuff we'll talk about, just to recap, core platform, compute, network, storage. Everything else is based on this. If you don't get these right, doesn't matter how good your high order service is. The foundation must be strong. What can each do? These numbers have changed. We've pulled them all together in one place. We'll do a walkthrough. Again, this may be a recap and a refresher for everyone, but I forget these numbers if I don't look at them every couple of weeks. And there's some interesting little nuances that we'll pick into. And how do we get the most density out of a system? So scalability and density are not the same thing. What I mean by density is for a given amount of resource, for this many cores, this much network, this much memory, how much work can I put through the system? When we do the scalability discussion, we'll talk about the path to scale is how do I get more stuff, and then how do I use it more efficiently. Traditional software optimization has been about density. I have a fixed capitalized asset. How do I get more work out of it? How do I optimize my algorithms? How do I tune my code? How do I drop profilers on it? This is actually probably even more relevant in a cloud services world, not for scalability, but for efficiency, cost of goods. If I stand up an extra large VM and I can get 10,000 requests a second out of it, okay, but that may or may not be good or bad. If I can make some small tweaks in my code and get 30 or 40 or 50,000, all of a sudden I just had a materially dramatic impact on the bottom line. We may think, well, we're selling utilization, that's probably a bad thing. No. We want our platform to be the most competitive, most efficient way to deliver services. As well, and this includes not just the core Azure platform, but our developer tools, .NET, all, you know, our web service stacks, all that good stuff, as well as the intra and inter-service communication patterns. Azure is inherently a distributed systems platform. The limit of scale and the limit of efficiency is largely the limit of your ability to stitch together the various components and services in an efficient fashion. When resigning on-prem with scale-up boxes, a lot of this stuff just gets lost as background noise. It's just overhead because we overbuy. If it takes me 6 months to spec and order and install, and then I have to amortize that investment over 3 years, I'm going to buy more than I need. So there's always that extra headroom. So a lot of these little things around network efficiency, they just get lost. Can't do it. We don't have that luxury when resigning for the cloud. Just one key note. Pretty much all of the techniques and approaches I'm talking about, they're not necessarily specific to Azure. The implementation details are, but I've used these patterns on Amazon. I've used them on Rackspace. The language might change. The incantation may change, but the physics are the same. So let's talk a little bit about core Azure application architecture, strictly talking about PaaS. So the foundation of everything when we're pushing out to Azure is a cloud-hosted service. Every one of these services has some set of finite resources that we need to collate together. So just talking about those three areas. How much work can I get from each individual unit? Am I using WebCF or Web API? What's the difference? Why does it matter? What are the engineering trade-offs that I'm explicitly or implicitly making every time I make one of these choices? How many can I compose together? How many VMs can I put in a cloud service before things start going strange? How many services can I put in a data center? How many storage accounts can I tie into a service? And then finally, how many are available? So you know the tagline, infinite capacity? Does anyone actually believe that? That's what I thought. So when we think about, the other thing I'll talk about is when we're thinking about rolling out very large units, if I go up to an Azure data center and I ask for 8,000 cores as a single entity, the fabric that controls it will probably look at me and go, no, you're crazy. I'm not giving you that much capacity in a single shot, because if that wasn't planned for, I need to allocate, you know, a huge amount of space. I might be taking it away from others. So where capacity in Azure is elastic, it is not infinite, both in terms of design and physical capacity. And for folks working on very large customer deployments, this starts to become highly relevant, especially if you're working. And we actually have a number of customers that routinely roll out 8,000 to 10,000 cores in a single deployment. It's composed of multiple individual services that then work together, but pushing out that much compute for a burst job is not unknown. Not saying it's terribly common. It tends to be very specific to intensely computational burst workloads, financial, insurance, tax preparation. Things that need a lot of compute for a short period of time, and then can stand that down again. So just kind of a quick recap through the high-level stuff, and then we'll dive down. Core item is the subscription is a billing and control and metadata entity. It doesn't actually have a life cycle. Subscriptions say here is how much resources you're allowed to have, and here is who is allowed to have access to it. Keeping in mind, a subscription is a very coarse-grained entity. I had a conversation with a customer last week who said, I want to roll out 147 applications and I only want to use one subscription. And I'm thinking, that's an interesting perspective. Please tell me more. The conversation went as, you're basically taking 147 apps and then giving every single person administrative privileges to destroy them all with a bad keystroke. You may want to reconsider this. So subscription is both a billing entity as well as a management entity. Most customers I know tend to have a reasonable number of subscriptions. A subscription for dev, QA, and production. The larger entities will tend to segment these by workloads. So it's not a one-size-fits-all, and it's not a everybody gets one. There's an interesting balance here. Most subscriptions come with a set of default resources. Who knows how to get those raised? Couple hands. At this point in time, to exceed the standard limits for a subscription, you have to call support. That is not a technical restriction, that is a billing one. It was more along the lines of not wanting to have to answer the question of, why did my junior dev 3 weeks out of college just roll out $100,000 worth of test? We didn't want him to do that. So that's why those subscription caps are in place. We have our hosted services consisting of a set of roles, which in turn contain instances. One of the things you get into when you're designing a very large-scale software is consistency. Not having multiple versions, not having, you know, different types of software and different types of bits out in the world. If you're designing from bare metal, you have to do all of this stuff yourself. You have to build the tools, you have to build the infrastructure. One of the reasons that PaaS is a little bit strange, like a suit that doesn't quite fit for developers who are new to it, is these restrictions are baked into the platform. You no longer have to worry about how do I roll out 15 copies of exactly the same software image. The system will not let you do anything else. This is part of, unfortunately, that impedance mismatch, that learning curve for people coming from building box software or even IaaS-based software to moving into a platform model. You get some of the things that you need for more scale and more manageability, but all of a sudden you lose control and you lose agility. There are ways around it, but that's the trade-off that are made. So once we get past hosted services, which we'll dig into a lot, we get into some of the core platform services, storage being the most important one. As opposed to other vendors, we have a unified storage architecture. Blobs, queues, and tables all run off of the same system. There is not one system for long-term storage and one system for mounting drives. We do have a unified system as opposed to, say, Amazon's EBS and S3. There are a number of higher order platform services that live on top of these. SQL Azure being the most common one, ACS for access control, Service Bus, as well as a host of new things that we have coming out. Those are still pretty platform level services, and we're starting to see the first and sometimes second generation of the real, something that almost lives somewhere between a platform as a service and software as a service. Is anyone using Azure Media Services? A couple of hands, yep. So Media Services is kind of a little peek into the future of some of the newer things, the higher order, higher value, more specialized services that we're building. I would like to be able to publish video channels as a service, Media Services. I would like to quickly spin up web applications and mobile applications, Azure Mobile Services. They're still built on the same foundation, but they're targeting kind of a richer area of applications. And of course, there's the stuff behind the scenes that makes all the magic work. There's the fabric that provisions machines, that sets up firewall rules, that does all that goodness. You won't see that directly, but it's interesting to think about kind of what's going on behind the scenes when I push out a hosted service, when I add a role, when I change the number of instances. Okay, so compute, without compute, we don't really have much of anything. So we'll talk a lot about compute. So a hosted service is the essential unit of compute. Hosted service can have any number of roles. The number is currently 25. This number is very likely to change in the future, especially as we push out towards infrastructure as a service. Inside a role, which is generally intended as, this is a unit of computation that I want to scale out, where everything here does the same job. I have a number of instances. Each instance is a VM running some fairly standardized OS image. The only difference between a worker role and a web role is that the web role takes the worker role image and adds IIS and then starts it. It is the same base platform image with a small tweak to the runtime that actually gets exposed. Essentially, for all intents and purposes, a web role is a macro to let you host web-centric code. You can run a web server in a worker role. There's nothing stopping you from doing that. It's just the web role says, please, when you deploy a web role, you're telling the service, or you're telling the platform, please do all the configuration and all the installation and all the magic necessary to host IIS, because I don't want to deal with that. That being the essence of deploying to the cloud is, there's a set of things I no longer want to deal with. This is one of them. Okay, key thing, these are immutable VMs. And not immutable in that I can't change them, but immutable in that any changes are thrown away. So anything that depends on local storage is gone. This is a hard enforcement of the separation of state and logic. In a canonical three-tier system, I have my web stuff, I have my app stuff, and I have my externalized state. Stateless middle tier, stateful back end. In this PaaS world, you don't have a choice. You have to build systems this way. We've been building this way for a long time anyway. Again, the platform is now saying, you no longer have a choice, you have to do things this way. This has a large number of consequences in terms of how we actually implement apps, I can't depend on the local file system being available and durable. If I need to make changes to my application, I can't just log into the box and hot edit the system. I have to push out through a regular configuration process. This will become very relevant when we talk about manageability and when we talk about availability. The number one absolutely leading cause of outage in major systems is organic. It's humans. It's people following a bad process or not following a process at all and pushing live changes out into production. This affects everyone. Almost, if you look in the news and you look at some of the major outages from Amazon, from us, from companies who put inordinate amounts of effort into getting their application lifecycle management correct, we still make mistakes. So anything that allows me to live edit a system in production fills me with terror if we're trying to maintain SLAs. You can't do that in this world. It feels weird, it's a little painful for dev, but in the limit, in a production system, this is valuable stuff. All right, so the hosted service boundary is a network boundary. It is an explicit network boundary. The hosted service gets one public virtual IP. Everything inside shares a private network space. And unless you perform some interesting magic with virtual networks, the only way to communicate from outside to inside is by exposing an endpoint, basically a port mapping between some external port and an internal role that will then be load balanced. The interesting part about the services exposing load balanced endpoints is that only one of your roles can be listening on port 80 or port 443. This means that if you have multiple web services that you want to deploy, you either need to co-locate them on the same web role or you need to deploy multiple services. If you deploy multiple services, they no longer have, by default, knowledge of each other's internals. This becomes very relevant when I want to do something like deploying a shared cache, for reasons that we'll talk deeply about when we talk about partitioning and affinity. Okay, who hasn't seen this chart? That's what I thought. So, these are the instances that we currently have available. In time, there will be more. This is the current set as of February 2013. It is February, right? Yeah. Okay, cool. I will occasionally throw in a completely obvious question just to see if anyone's paying attention. So normally when we think about buying hardware, we think bigger and badder is better. I want the biggest, meanest server. I want to rack me up terabytes of RAM, put a 454 V8 in this thing, and let's hit the highway. This, by and large, and I'll talk about the exceptions, is a very poor choice when we're running in Azure for a couple of different reasons. In general, for stateless web workloads, we want a larger number of smaller instances. There are only one or two exceptions in the PaaS world. We'll cover them a little later. And in general, I always deploy either small or medium roles with a certain number of cores as my web tier. And by all means, don't be afraid to throw questions out. So why do we do this? Really, there's two reasons. One is context switching is expensive. If putting out a machine is an API call, it's just as easy to deploy 10 machines with two cores as it is to deploy five machines with four cores. If I have a larger number of smaller machines, it's easier for the fabric to do placement. Fragmentation. It's easier to take a small thing and put it into a shared set than it is a large thing, whether that's memory, whether that's disk, files on disk, or whether it's VMs in a hypervisor farm. The physics are the same. If I want to push out a large number of extra large VMs, I have to find physical machines that have contiguous intact space for an 8-core deployment. That can be bad. If I go out and say I need 500 XL machines, the hypervisor needs to go, I need a large number of physical machines that have 8 spare cores, as opposed to going, hey, I need a large number of 2-core or 4-core machines. Can you just spread those around? So locality and fragmentation. This is the other reason why large number, small instances. The only real exception is when you do need locality of memory. So if web roles and you're designing them to be mostly stateless, that's great. Most applications at scale will involve a distributed cache. And the fewer number of distributed cache nodes I have, the fewer number of network connections I need in that mesh in order to be able to access it. So for cache nodes, I generally recommend XLVMs. But I might have 100 or 120 web role instances and a couple of dozen cache roles or cache nodes. Yeah, so again, that's really the kind of the only area where I think about XLVMs in the PaaS world is for those semi-stateful, high-memory workloads. The other thing is extra small, great for test, great for functional evaluation, and great for coordinator processes. But you'll note that the network bandwidth there is very sublinear. So that's a thing to watch out for. The difference between a small and a medium, to me, it's not even so much about the cores as it is about the network bandwidth available. If I start getting network bound, I might want to kick up a little bit. If I'm CPU bound, it's a bit of a play. Sure.
Question. I think that the bandwidth actually is also based on the storage I/O. So it's network bandwidth out of the box to outside world.
Yeah, excellent point. So the network bandwidth is in both directions, both on the services you expose externally as well as your communication to your back-end systems, whether that be storage or SQL or another tier. And since most of these web applications are going to be heavily I/O bound, definitely need to keep an eye on that. And the interesting part is the more efficient you get about managing your network, the more the denser your applications are, the closer to these limits you're going to start hitting. When we talk about asynchronous programming, we're talking about optimizing, basically blocking the CPU while we're doing I/O work. Once we go more asynchronous, we tend to start exhibiting network pressure because we've removed one bottleneck and we've gotten further down the road and hit another. But an excellent point about network is not just outbound. It's your composite. It's your complete set of network resources, which is one of the other reasons why doing live logging to an external file store in a production app is generally a bad idea.
Have you seen any serious deployments for small instances that are used?
The question is, have I seen any serious deployments where an extra small instance are used? No, I have seen no true production deployments that were using extra small in the way that they were intended. All right, so who's familiar with fault domains and upgrade domains? A couple hands. I'll go back over because this is critically important and has some interesting ramifications. So essentially, once you get beyond a certain number of machines, once you get beyond a certain number of moving parts, failure is inevitable. You can buy the most robust big iron on the planet, and if you roll out 1,000 of them, something will always be failing. When you have hundreds of thousands of machines, something is failing constantly. So you can fight that by trying to build what we like to refer to as the titanium eggshell. Works to a certain size, doesn't work beyond it. The physics and the math and the kind of statistics around failure are fairly well known. Lots of great articles out there. The ramification is we can't buy our way past failure, so we have to design around it. And how Azure surfaces this concept is through fault domains and upgrade domains. Essentially, what a fault domain says is I'm going to treat a set of resources as a unit that fails atomically. So if I think of a rack of machines, I've got a bunch of machines sharing a set of power supplies and a top of rack router. That thing, if any of those components fail, that whole set is offline. That is a physical instantiation of a fault domain. As developers, we are now abstracted from that, and basically the contract from the fabric is, here are the set of things that can fail as a set, and if you deploy with multiple fault domains, I will ensure that I put resources on multiple racks. I will ensure that I isolate resources from common points of failure. What exactly those points of failure are, one, I'm not going to tell you. Two, you don't have to worry about it. This is the abstraction. Just like we build abstract interfaces in software, this is the abstract interface against the fabric that says, we will continue to innovate and build out and do interesting things underneath. What you have to develop against is this concept that if you tell me to put stuff in two fault domains, I will do my best to isolate them from common failure points. This is why if you roll out a single instance in one failure domain, Azure says, you get no SLA. Question?
What's the mechanism that's used in the web tier role to provide cross-hop?
Yep. Excellent question is, how do we provide communication between roles in the case of failure? That's the second half of the presentation. See, I didn't even pay him to cue that up. You've been reading ahead. Maybe he has a copy of the slides. An upgrade domain is the flip side of that, which is saying one of the things we are promising to you as part of PaaS is that patching and upgrades, that's our problem now. If you want, and you can disable this, and I'll talk briefly in a second about when you want to disable this, I, as the fabric, will go through and keep your stuff up to date. I will apply all the appropriate patches. I will do the OS upgrades. I will just make this stuff happen. And the reason the fabric can do this is that when I roll out a web roll or work roll, it's the base VM image plus my immutable software package on top. So I don't actually upgrade in place. What Azure actually does is says, all right, it's time to upgrade. I'm going to stand up a new machine, install the software, and then just roll that image right over top of the old one there. It's not modification in place. It's basically a replacement. So this is where the number of upgrade domains becomes very, very interesting. So when I do an in-place upgrade, when I say, hey, Azure, I have a new package. I would like to upgrade this application in place. The same mechanism is used. If I have three upgrade domains, I'm going to go and replace 30%, well, 33.3333% of my capacity with the new bits, and then the next one, and then the next one. This is actually the mechanism by which you can do partial deployments and partial rollouts, because you can script this. By default, when I say do an in-place upgrade, it hits one upgrade domain, the next upgrade domain, and the one after that. But the APIs are there that if I want to do graduated rollout, say I have five upgrade domains, I can take my N plus one software, I can push it out to my live site, and I can stop there, and I can wait, and I can monitor, and I can go, okay, this new stuff, it's working. And then I can push out to 40% and 60% and 80%. Unfortunately, where we are today with SDK 1.8, you have to script all this, but it is possible. The door is there. It's not locked, but it does stick a little bit, so you tend to have to put a bit of work around it. Question in the back? So the question is, can I take one of the upgrade domains out of the load balancer? So when I go and I push out an upgrade, there's a life cycle that the VM follows. The first one is I'm busy, aka I'm removed from the load balancer. It then swaps, and when it reaches a point in the code, so you know when you do like your web role CS and your worker role CS, there's that ready state? Until you hit the ready state, when you hit the ready state, you tell the load balancer, hey, I am come back to life. I am now ready to receive external work. So there, you can do that either kind of as a side effect of doing an upgrade, or if you actually wanted to pull, if a node wants to pull itself out of the load balancer temporarily, say to download some initialization file, there's also a code path for doing that. So if the question is, say if I wanted to do a partial rollout, see what the results were and then pull back, essentially what you'd then be doing is the same process, only you'd be upgrading to V-1. So it's always a replace, but you'd just be replacing it with the old version. One of the things we'll talk about in manageability is about keeping those packages as versioned entities and the configuration with them, and having a scripted rollout experience so that you can do things like, oh, we just pushed a bad build. Well, we have, you know, V-1 and V-2 and V-3 sitting as versioned entities either in our source control system or some other mechanism, so we can go back in time, as it were. All right. So there's a few simple animations here. This is talking about the physical instantiation in terms of racks and kind of how it's done out. I wouldn't, normally when we think, we like to, you know, we're all nerdy folks. At least I like to think so, because we're all here talking about software. We like to dig right down into the guts and go, what is physically happening here? Even just saying rack is an abstraction, it may change in the future. So. Okay, so let's talk about the service boundary. This is one, this gets a little weird. This is one I've had to, a lot of times I've bounced into really strange kind of design. It has to do with this. The hosted service is a network boundary. It is essentially, for all intents and purposes, a firewall, a load balancer, and a network address translator. And the only way in or out is through that load balancer, sort of. There's a small twist on this now. So a couple of ramifications around scalability. I have a single VIP for the service, a single virtual IP. This limits the actual number of connections that can be established because of the size of an IPv4 routing table. We'll come back to that one in scalability. I can only get at internal instances through the load balancer. That means I pay the cost of a load balancer transition to hit a web role, or actually to hit any internal role. So there's an automatic latency cost on every balanced communication through the system. If you're doing extremely low latency workloads, this could be a problem. Now granted, if you're doing extremely low latency workloads over large distances, your design probably has a few challenges to begin with. So when I go and I expose an input endpoint, an external endpoint for all intents and purposes, I'm saying this protocol, HTTP or TCP, for this port maps to this role and this port. So I can take external port 80 and map it to web role 1 port 732. There's nothing stopping me from doing that. By default, it's 80 to 80, 443 to 443. But only one role can be bound to 80 or 443 or any of the well-named ports, which means that if you're exposing an external service, only one role can do this. When I say the documentation says that connections are round-robined, it's actually kind of loose. You're actually generally randomly assigned. When I come in through the load balancer and I hit an instance, the load balancer is going, here's the next one. It's not guaranteed to be a monotonic sequence across the instances. So anything that any design that requires locality will not work by default. We do not support session or temporal-based affinity to a certain point. But in general, when you hit an instance, you'll get pinned there for about 4 minutes. Otherwise, you get excessive jitter, any kind of caching or locality goes away. That is the intent of the load balancer, but it is not a contract in the documentation. That behavior can change. It used to be you'd get pinned for 1 minute, now it's 4 minutes. That behavior may change again in the future. If you have a design that requires cookie-based affinity or application-level affinity, you cannot do it with the Azure Load Balancer. You have to employ an additional layer. For example, who's used ARR, Application Request Routing, the module in IIS? You can implement an affinitizing reverse proxy in Azure using ARR. Folks familiar with Antares, or I probably should give it the public name, Azure Websites. Yep, a lot of nods. Azure Websites uses ARR to basically take an incoming connection and then pin it to the instance that is running the web, you know, kind of that internal website. That's how they get high density. So, and this technique is available to us to use in more general purpose apps. You don't only tend to need it if you're doing, so for a CSV that has a lot of customers that it wants to isolate individualized customer code, this is a very applicable approach. And we can talk a little bit more about that if folks are interested once we kind of get through some of the high level stuff. Right, so role-to-role communication. We finally have internal endpoints available. I have two options. I can either look at the service manifest and then build my own load balancing, my own service affinity based on knowledge of the network topology, or I can use an internal load balancing endpoint that basically figures out who's active and who bounces. The question earlier was, how do I go from my web role to my worker role without leaving the service? If I basically want to just create direct TCP or HTTP channels, I can either hit an internal endpoint or I can keep a map of the topology in memory, because every time a node comes down or goes up, I get a notification. So I can build a hash table or a dictionary if you want to use the .NET terminology, and then I can go directly to the node. It's a little more advanced in general, not as necessary. There is a new feature which is very poorly documented. Unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to hunt down the specific MSDN link before I gave this presentation, but I will make sure it gets out on my blog soon, is that I can say, hey, port 1478 goes to instance 4. Port 1479 goes to instance 5. I can now create instance endpoints that bypass the load balancer. They still go through the load balancer, but they don't go through the logic. It's a direct pin. This is commonly used if I need to drop latency. If I can't pay the load balancer hit, say for example if I was sharing a cache between multiple services or I needed to do chatty communication, this is a technique I might employ. The downside of this is I am now responsible for availability. If that individual instance goes down, I need to have some sort of compensation mechanism. I may need to go back to a service locator and say, which instance should I use now? I can't get to that one anymore. So again, the door is open. There are Anyone using DocDB, the early previews? So it uses this technique in order to streamline access for latency reasons. This all making sense? Everything's kind of, no one's run away screaming yet. It's usually a good sign. Okay, so let's get into storage. So if I hear one more person come up to me and talk about these completely stateless applications, I may end up in prison orange. There is no such thing as a useful, purely stateless application. The only point of software is to manipulate state for humans at some point. So since our PaaS roles are by their very design purely stateless, state has to live somewhere. Most software design in Azure is figuring out what stateful stores are available and then composing them together with the appropriate validation and security and all that good stuff. So understanding storage and what it can do at its base level is very important for being able to design Azure applications that work the way we intend. All right, so an Azure storage account. We'll talk about limits, then we'll talk about capabilities. We've recently, back in November, announced Azure Storage Generation 2, which increases a lot of limits and adds a bunch of new capabilities. The storage limit for an Azure account is now 200 terabytes. This is actually pretty fascinating that I can have 200 terabytes of storage with an API call, and I pay for what I use as I go. The storage capacity, again, the 200 terabytes, I can split that up however I want. It's the aggregate capacity for the entire storage account, for the blobs, the queues, and the tables. I can now have 20,000 operations. We call them transactions, but they're not transactions in the database sense. It's really just operations, calls against this service. I can now have up to 20,000 a second. It used to be 5,000. This is part of that continuous improvement of the base platform. So remember that this is an aggregate value over everything in that storage account. So if I'm using 15,000 ops a second for my tables, I only have 5,000 left for blobs. So if you have workloads that are both highly orthogonal as well as intense, we're going to want to start splitting up storage accounts for specific purposes.
Question? Is there a viewpoint that tells you what service, cloud service, VM, or whatever role is affecting how many transactions for a storage account?
So the question is, how do I know, if I can paraphrase just a little bit, how do I know who's using which storage account and how much are they using? One of the things we'll go into when we talk about scalability is the Azure storage logging and how to get basically call-by-call insight into exactly what is going on. So the information is available. You just have to do a little bit of work in case you need a specific KPI. But turning on logging is you can go into the portal and say, please log everything that goes in here. And it's all asynchronous, loaded to files. So the only thing you're really paying for is not a performance cost. It's just that if you start cranking a few hundred megs of log files a day, well, you have to pay for them. But again, it's that trade-off. So bandwidth. Storage comes in two flavors, which is a configuration experience, geo-redundant and non-geo-redundant. Every Azure data center has a mirror data center within that geopolitical region. So West US region is mirrored to East US. North is mirrored to South. South is mirrored to North. What that means is when I go and I write to a storage account and make a mutable operation against the storage account in one region, that change, that delta, is asynchronously replicated to another data center for disaster recovery. We're going to talk a lot about disaster recovery and how that's actually not all that relevant in a cloud world as compared to providing availability. Disaster recovery is Godzilla stepped on the data center, and we won't lose data, and we'll bring the other data center up in the fullness of time. It is not, I need no more than 5 seconds of downtime in a given week. Disaster recovery, availability, two very different things. The reason I tend to press on that a little bit is coming from spending a lot of time with SQL folks in the traditional enterprise SQL community. Disaster recovery and complete availability tend to be conflated. So we'll tease those apart and talk about approaches and techniques to get where you need to go. So I can choose to have the data replicated to another data center or not. If I choose to have it replicated, I'm getting data availability, or basically that assurance that the data will be available in a different region, but I'm giving up throughput. So you can see the numbers for redundant and non-geo-redundant. If I don't need to have that data backed up in another data center, if I can recreate it or if I'm going to do it myself, this is an interesting trade-off. Availability, three nines. So how do we build 5 9 systems on 3 9's platforms? I'm going to talk a lot about that. GODR is configurable. You get it by default. You have to turn it off if you don't want it. This is either part of the API call or in the portal when you create the account. I have exceeded 20,000 operations a second or the number of target operations for the subsystem. This is all over HTTP. You get the standard HTTP code for please go away, I'm not having a good day right now. If you come back later, I might talk to you. Or more technically, you get a 503 server busy. And by default, in a subscription, you can have 5 storage accounts. I think that may have been raised to 20 now, I'm not sure. But either way, that's just a billing entity. If you want more, you pick up the phone and you go, hey, Azure support, I have more money, I would like more storage. If your customers are looking at very large numbers of storage accounts, if they're looking at storing multiples of petabytes, seems like a big number, we have a number of customers who do that, these are sorts of things that we do need to plan for in advance. Okay, so a couple of things on the side. We already talked about the, every time I do a write locally within a data center, I get a quorum commit to 3 nodes, meaning that I come in on the primary, that data is then replicated out to at least 2 other nodes that then acknowledge, hey, this data is now safely written in at least 3 places. Because just like compute uses fault domains, storage uses fault domains. They're built on the same infrastructure. There's a great white paper out there that goes into the low-level details. So this is one of the reasons why I look at the latency. We get fully consistent writes at the expense of latency, and that's one thing you can't change. So that SLA says that for a certain period of time, every month, our intention, our agreement, is that we will process requests that are valid, and we will provide connectivity to storage. And if we cannot do that, we will give you money back. Very important to remember what an SLA is. It's not a, this will never happen. It is our utmost intent that this will never happen, and if it does, you will be financially compensated. Important to keep that in mind. Access. This is one that's really important. When you're working at the lowest levels of the system, you want a minimal number of dependencies. You don't want a fancy authentication scheme that has 6 dependencies itself. We'll talk a lot about that in availability. So when I'm going into the storage accounts, I really have 2 options. I can go in with a primary and a secondary key, which is essentially just a crypto key that I attach to my API calls. I have a primary and a secondary so that I can swap them in production. This is something that most people do not build into their applications, and they require application upgrade in order to modify storage signatures. That's okay. Again, it's just a choice you need to make. Do I put the developer time and cost into being able to live swap storage signatures, or do I simply say, it's okay, I'll do it during my next planned upgrade, because I only rotate my keys every 90 days. The challenge is, a primary or a secondary storage key is a skeleton key. It gives you administrative rights to everything, which means that if you want to constrain what people can do, you have 2 choices. You either need to provide some services interface, where you mediate the request, increasing latency, increasing complexity, or you can use what's called a shared access signature, which means that an application can go and request a time-bounded signature that says, here's who you are, here's what you're allowed to do for how long. You are allowed to write to this table partition for 4 hours. You are allowed to read from this blob container for a day. If you have applications that you want to let into your storage account in a very constrained way, this is the ideal way to do it. For example, if I have a mobile application that wants to write data into blob storage, I have 2 choices. I can write a mediator service, an intermediary web service that intercepts data from the mobile client and then pushes it into blob storage. And for small scale stuff, that's fine. But when I'm operating with millions of devices, I'm basically adding a lot of cost and complexity versus having the mobile client pull down a shared key and then write directly into blob storage. Shared access signatures are how you do that. Before, you would have had to give someone the keys to the kingdom. That's just not going to happen. SAS tokens are one of these. They're not terribly well known. We don't do a great job of publicizing them, but they're extremely powerful. Has anyone used SAS guy before? Okay.
So question came up with a partner this week, in fact, geo-replication.
Yep.
Right now, it's very much we're doing geo-replication, trust us. This client, your partner, is asking,
yep. So the question is around geo-replication of storage, and more importantly, availability and checking to see that the data is indeed replicated. We will cover that in availability. This is my usual dodge for, I have slides for that coming, we'll get there. Question in the back?
Mm-hmm. So they were like, well, how are you actually doing the trip? They didn't understand the fault and upgrade domains and how we split those across the two data centers.
So the question, I guess, if I can paraphrase, is you were working with a customer who was having difficulty understanding fault and upgrade domains versus multi-DC availability?
Right.
Okay. Yeah, and that's the key thing is when we talk about fault and upgrade domains, that's isolated to a single cloud service in a single data center. When we want to go multi-DC, we need to be, a lot of that is going to be in terms of how we design applications. The traditional on-premise approach for handling these kinds of availability is purely stateless services and let the backing store handle replication and failover to another data center. Log shipping, SQL mirroring, always on availability groups with asynchronous push. That's the underlying backing stores in Azure do not provide live failover. Failing over from one data center to another data center is a Godzilla level event. We will only do it if we truly lose the entire data center or a very large segment of it. We have had partial availability events. Every other cloud vendor has had them, so this pattern still is in place. Or if I lost an entire rack, or if I lost half of my storage or a quarter, we would probably not fail over that data center because that would be more destructive than taking the partial availability hit for some customers. So if we're talking about where someone needs full availability online and needs to drive higher SLAs, at this point in time, GeoDR and geo-replication from the core platform, the core storage, is not how you do it. We'll talk about how you can do it. Again, the platform is continuously evolving to make these scenarios, to take these scenarios out of the hands of developers and put them in the platform as a declaration of intent as opposed to having to write code to do it. The reality is today, you have the design for it. Okay. Touch a little bit about optimizing storage accounts. There's a lot of detail on this. There's some nuances. Who's using Storage Library 2.0? Okay. I hope that very soon after we've had this discussion, you will all run out and go, I know there's a lot of breaking changes. I know it's going to be painful to change, but the upside is so big, I can't not upgrade. The new storage libraries are up to 300% faster than the Storage 1.0 libraries. They are significantly faster, significantly simpler, far more lightweight. It's a painful swap, I know, but you can get there. And we'll shortly be publishing how to do asynchronous work with the storage libraries using tasks as opposed to that hideously ugly iasync completion stuff. Who hates APM and iasync complete? Oh, yeah. We all hate that. Come on, it's 2013. Can we get away from the .NET 1.0 APIs, please? Okay, some basic optimization of storage accounts as a whole. Turn off Nagle and expect 100. It's the basic stuff. Turn off proxy detection. This is just stuff you're going to have in your role start just to set up and optimize the VM. Storage metrics and logging. We probably can do a demo some point today. Go in, turn on logging. We're going to really go into this in manageability, but if you did not log it, it did not happen. Or at least you'll never know it happened. It's cheap. It doesn't hit your throughput or your latency numbers. It's just a little bit of storage, but that information is critical in diagnosing issues or even just understanding your usage patterns. We talked a lot about primary and secondary keys and shared access signatures. One of the things we'll spend a lot of time on, both in terms of data considerations and in terms of designing for scale, is understanding partitioning and hotspots. Storage accounts as a whole have a limit of 20,000 ops a second. Smaller services within them have different limits, and understanding them is the key to scale, as well as why some of our default experiences don't work terribly well. So if I see code that says add message, and to queue, and the function is implemented as initialize queue object, create queue object if it's not there, and then add message. And I have seen this. Who's seen that? Come on. Oh, yeah. Yes, every single demo ever written is terrible. Because what you're doing there is saying, I wish to give Microsoft more money in exchange for doing less work. What you've said is every single time I go to add a message to a queue, which is one operation, I wish to perform up to 3 or 4. Because begin if not there is a call out to validate that the queue exists, which may, in storage 1.0, this throws an internal exception, because everything in storage 1.0 throws an internal exception instead of passing an error code. So you've just gone out, you've burned one of your operations, you've unrolled your stack for no apparent reason at all before you've done any useful work. You've just halved the throughput of your system by doing something that seemed obvious. So this needs to be in one-shot initialization code. Retry policies. Everything is an external service to your process. As soon as you cross the process boundary, as soon as you cross the network boundary, there are no guarantees. Intermittent issues happen. You get throttled out. You have a temporary loss of connectivity. Some machine is having a cranky day. Storage 2.0 has some really good retry policies baked into it. You must use them for reliable code. Co-location should be obvious. I should not have to make this statement, but I will because we still see it. If your compute is here and your storage is 3,000 miles away, electrons have mass. This mass is not zero. If they have to go all the way and then back again, this takes time. The speed of light is a hard constraint. We have not broken this yet. Customers will do this, usually by accident. They'll usually not set up the proper availability or the region groups. So this is just something to check for. I have had any number of complaints going, this is too much latency. Why are you shoveling bits halfway across the continent when they need to move like three racks over? Use a different storage account for diagnostics. This is something else I shouldn't have to mention, but this has brought down production Microsoft services. We have done this ourselves. This is a common one of separation of concerns. It's not just for architecture and interfaces. It's also for physical topology. You must have a dedicated storage account for diagnostics, and so many people get this wrong because you get contention at the worst possible time. If I get a huge amount of work coming in that generates a huge number of logs and they're all going to the same place, I get a hotspot, I get contention, everything backs up. And of course, back to, if you're not using the storage 2.0 library, you are throwing away resources and just giving yourself a headache. All right, got about 8 or 9 minutes left. I won't get to the storage patterns, I'll cover them a little later, but this is the foundation. You've got to know these numbers and know these patterns. This is, you know, otherwise you're walking in quicksand. Blobs come in two forms, block and page. You can tell me the difference.
So block blobs are great for streaming data in and out.
Mm-hmm.
Page blobs work better for random access.
Absolutely. Block blobs are, here's data, put it there as an intact entity. Page blobs exist for one reason, VHDs. They really have no other real use. But they're expressly designed for the random access patterns are different than the writing stuff in place pattern. Whether it's streaming, whether it's just an upload, which is a very large stream, but don't use page blobs when block blobs can do. Your block blobs should always be your default for a couple of reasons. One, they're just generally more efficient for this. Because they're being written in larger blocks, the system can handle them more efficiently. I can't tell you the other reason. Okay. If you're doing partial reads, if you're streaming out, you want to use 64 kilobyte page size. That's just what the system is best suited to be able to pull out. We have the new API came out last summer called the async copy. Does anyone use async copy? If you need, a couple hands. If you need to move blobs, if you need to move data, async copy is phenomenal because you go to the storage system and you say, hey, storage system, I would like to take this blob from this other HTTP endpoint that's living in Amazon, that's living somewhere external, and I want you to do all the work of efficiently bringing it in. Whether you're copying between storage accounts or even between providers, async copy is your friend.
It's the only operation in storage, I think, that actually has an SLA on its execution.
It is indeed one of the only public APIs that actually has an SLA. It is really great. So a couple of notes around the kind of the capabilities for individual blobs. Maximum individual blob, 200 gig, pretty good. Each individual blob will give you 60 megabytes per second of bandwidth. That is your cap against a single blob. That's the cap there. This is not as relevant when you're just using blobs as files. This becomes very relevant when we start getting to VHDs and infrastructure as a service. And the ability to scale out blob usage is pretty simple. Just you want more bandwidth, use more blobs. All right, I'm just going to skip past this because we already talked about a lot of this. Table storage. So we're gonna cover this a lot in the next one. I talk about sparse columnar arrays, but this is essentially what table storage is. It is key to an array of values. These values can be orthogonal schema. Storage 1.0 libraries will not let you take advantage of all the capabilities of table storage. The system is more powerful than its initial APIs. If I wanted to say store information about a user, in table storage I can say I have 5 rows. I have their name, their profile, and all of these things are stored in the same partition. So if I need to access them, I can access them all at once. Table storage is for storing fully normalized orthogonal schema. It is not a relational store. If you treat it like one, it will hurt. Okay, so it is great at anything that requires key value lookup. If I want to store information where I can always get to it by having one or two pieces of deterministic data, table storage is fantastic. If I need to ask a question like, please give me all of the users that fit these 6 or 7 characteristics, you're asking a relational problem, get a relational database. There's an interesting tipping point we'll get to in the next session that talks about it. If you need to get a lot of operations through table storage, using multiple tables doesn't really help you all that much because you're bound on the partition. You can have more partitions within a single table up to the limit of the storage account. So I can get 2,000 operations per second out of a table partition. If I want 20,000, I need 10 partitions. If I need 40,000, I need 10 partitions in two storage accounts. Well, 20 partitions across two storage accounts. Only thing to watch out for is the maximum column size, either byte or string, is about 64K, and that my partition key and my row keys are really the map. There's no secondary indices. So if I basically need to ask questions about the values, I need to pull the data down locally and filter it there. I'm not projecting a full filtering function up to the service. Sometimes the link surface in the storage 1.0 libs hid this. Very important to watch out for. The scale-out unit is the partition, so you need to think very carefully about choosing your partitions. Okay, so I'm just going to close out with queues. This is the third foundational element. Queues are actually built on top of tables. A queue actually is a table partition with some special APIs around it. So that's why the numbers are... I have not updated this slide. Please, I apologize. The throughput for a queue is 2,000 messages a second, not 500. This is old storage. So even with a bunch of tech reviews, we still miss a few things. All right, maximum size of a message in a queue is 8K. That means that queues are for command messages. They are not for data. If I get a large document that needs to be processed, then I'm going to trigger work with a queue. I can't pump it through the queue. It's not designed for that. What I'm going to need to do is take the work, put it in blob storage, and then put a pointer, a declaration of intent, in a queue. This is a very common pattern. But as soon as I need to do that, I have to worry about consistency between what's in my blobs and what's in my queues. So I don't have a magical transaction coordinator anymore. At the same time, I'm not paying the cost of going through a magical transaction coordinator. If I need more throughput, I must partition my queues. If I need more queues to do the same work, I need to horizontally partition. Q1 to Q2, Q3, spread work between them. If I have different functions, I will probably have different queues to allocate between them. In a world where I have to manage services individually, it makes sense to consolidate. In a cloud world where these are API calls, it makes sense to separate things so I don't get hot neighbor effects. If I have two types of work going into the same queue and they have different SLAs, if I get a huge flood of low priority work, that's going to drown out the high priority work. So implementing priority queues is another form of creating different types of queues in a verticalized sense. If your messages are not pulled out after a week, they get killed by the system. Again, if you need something that keeps them around longer than that, this is probably not the storage medium for you. So we're having some great discussions, so we kind of took a little bit longer to get through stuff, but that's all good. So I'll come back. The canonical web application. This is how most really bad systems on Azure are implemented. We'll get to why very, very shortly. Traditional three-tier web application. You'll note, but Mark, there's only one tier there. Have you suddenly gone crazy? But no, I say, there's a reason for this. This gets us into some interesting SOA philosophy and what the concept of a service boundary is. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say most folks are familiar with SOA, service-oriented architecture, service composition, interface development. No one's looking at me like I'm completely crazy, so I'm going to take that as a yes. This makes a lot of sense in a world of having fully decomposed services when I'm actually doing deployments machine by machine. It gives me the ability to swap sets of my application in a fairly loosely coupled way. The Azure deployment model changes some of the mechanics of this equation. All of a sudden, I'm deploying services as an atomic, intact entity. What this means is I gain no benefit. I get none of the benefits that the traditional implementation, not the philosophy, but the implementation gets me by deploying separate web and app logic on two different tiers. All it buys me is additional failure modes, additional latency, and lower throughput. If I have business and application logic, do not confuse binary deployment and binary compatibility advancement for service level. These are going out as an intact, intact atomic service. Put all the stuff on the same role. You're going to get a lot more efficiency that way. Full three-tier applications have crushed at least four customer engagements that I've been involved with because of the latency of going from the load balancer to the web app through a full protocol translation to an app tier and then to the database. And you might think, well, I want to be able to scale these independently. Well, actually, if you're doing proper asynchronous work and you've got your display logic and your business logic co-located on the same role, and you want more capacity, just add more nodes. Because if the same node that takes the web request is the one doing the business logic, then that becomes a unit of work. Very strange for traditional enterprise SOA, but as soon as I start deploying in the cloud model, collapsing the tiers makes sense for efficiency and complexity. Because now, I don't have to have a working web instance and a working app instance. I just have the number of failure modes that I needed to deal with. Now, as with everything, there's a trade-off. And it's not a trade-off that'll hit most systems, but it's a trade-off that happens when we talk real scale. Is that all of a sudden, remember what the load balancer does, I get zero affinitization through the load balancer. Which means that if I have 120 web role instances, every single one of those will be creating connections to my stateful store, to my databases, to my distributed cache. So the number of sockets can get substantial. Now's a good time. I've used this enough in public presentations that I can use it again. So remember, there's actually this web service boundary around here, and that database in a large scale system is not a single database, but many scale out databases. So let's do some basic math here. Given that a database cluster in SQL Azure has a single virtual IP address, and that a cloud service has a single virtual IP address, what is the maximum number of connections that can be created between those two points? 65,530 some odd, absolutely. Because that's how many ports I can have in the map between any two IPv4 addresses with a fixed destination port. So, if I have 120 web role instances, 500 databases, and a default connection pool size of 100, and no affinity through the load balancer, how many connections can I possibly create or attempt to create between those two services? Because that database is an external service. You can grab a calculator and do the math, but let's just say it's significantly larger than 65,000. Significantly. So one of the interesting downsides of collapsing the tiers in a very large scale systems is you lose affinity, which means you can create connection meshes, explosive connection meshes. And if you're working with a stateful protocol, connections to storage, it's HTTP. Every individual connection is largely stateless, in that all of the information required to complete every command is carried in every operation. TDS, the tabular data stream for SQL Server, is a heavily stateful connection. That's why SQL does connection pooling, because it's expensive to connect to SQL, to validate, to authenticate, and to set all of the connection context. So one thing to watch out for, we'll cover how to work around that in the scalability section. It's a little tidbit of, this is normally what people do for efficiency, but as with every engineering decision, you get some, you give some. In the immortal philosophical context, there is no such thing as a free lunch. All I want to do is kind of lay out the menu. All right. So the question is, are there documents that describe this problem? Yes, we have a 60-page white paper on exactly how everything I'm talking about today, there is a white paper out with a lot of detail. And we do a pretty periodic refresh on the white paper content to try and keep it up to date as we bring out new capabilities and as we learn more about the platform. Okay, so in this world, each service call invokes the database to manage durable external state. If that one little tidbit doesn't send everyone screaming away, running in terror, we'll get to the point where, as soon as you hear this, you will cringe in terror. Let's just reiterate that one more time. Every service call goes to the database. Everyone's looking, going, I think I know what's wrong, but I'm not sure, and I don't want to say it. Every single service call goes to a centralized, stateful store. It's a choke point. This pattern brings down more services on Azure than I can state, because for 10 or 15 years, the traditional developer approach to solving this problem has been throwing a checkbook at it. And I'm not against that. I've spent a long time in the SQL Server engineering group. Throwing hardware at a problem is not a bad thing until we move to the cloud. The number of applications I've seen that have a web tier and one database, which is fantastic for small scale stuff, but as soon as you crank up the load, there is basically, it's fully synchronous, and the limit of scale is the limit of the durable store. And if you have one durable store, you have a global choke point. SQL Azure databases are not SQL Server databases. SQL Azure is a database as a service designed to give you lots and lots of small databases. It is not designed to give you one enormous database. This is where most people start. This does not scale. So let's have a quick peek at what this physically looks like. So this is an implementation of a basic .NET 4.5 synchronous web API call out to a backing database. Standard API controller, you know, simple GET stuff. You go to my data access layer, and I have my bog standard synchronous SQL code. No optimizations, just if you've seen a SQL tutorial, you've seen this code. The only difference is I'm coming back with enumerables instead of actual arrays. Nothing. This is perfectly correct code, but it will not scale. Not because of this partially, because this is a blocking I.O. operation. And this is a blocking I.O. operation. And why is blocking I.O. in a web pipeline bad? Exactly. It ties up the request. And why that's bad is how the IIS pipeline, or actually indeed how most web server pipelines work. Spawning a thread per request in the Windows world is usually not a good idea. You end up, you spend a lot of time context switching, you spend a lot of time overscheduling. So instead, what IIS does is it creates a pipeline of incoming requests. It's a work queue. And then it says, I'm going to create 12 dispatch threads for every core by default. So on a large four-core machine in Azure, I get 48 dispatch threads. And as work arrives, I take the work off the queue, I drop it in that thread, and then I execute it. You know, I've been at the grocery store and the person in front of you is paying with pennies and has 72 coupons? Oh yeah, everyone's been there. Or you've been at the airport behind the person who doesn't know how to use the ticket machine. This is an example of what happens in a fixed width queue or dispatch queue when one operation perturbs the system. If you get enough slow actors in that dispatch model, it brings the whole system down, and it doesn't take very much. As soon as you get under load, that database will start to slow down, becomes a contention point, and it will push back. It will slow down. In return, folks will hang out in the dispatch queue, and very quickly, I have seen this happen in 30 seconds, the machine hits its limit, which is 5,000 pending requests for IIS by default, and says, I'm full, I'm too busy, I'm 302, service unavailable. Azure goes, okay, you're not available anymore. I'm going to pull you out of the load balancer and put work somewhere else. And then we experience what we colloquially term as a cascading systemic failure, as the load gets bigger and bigger and bigger and crushes your entire system. This is bad. Let's not have systems that do that. So we're just going to talk about a few simple changes. So we go async. Whether you use Node.js or whether you use C# 4.5, let's go async, which means that I'm going to interleave my requests And because I'm I.O. bound, when I'm not processing work, I'm not going to sit around and wait and block that thread. I'm going to say, I'm waiting for some stuff. Wake me up when you're ready. And this was almost impossible to do before 4.5. I had been doing concurrent programming for about 17 years, and I would never go near writing an asynchronous web app before now because it was too complicated, too error-prone, and I would always get it wrong. So let's look at what happens in an asynchronous world and with some very small changes. Now, there's additional complexity. You have to kind of understand how some of this stuff works. There's a few nuances, and you still have the problem of this is a density improvement. I'm more efficiently using the resources available. But this just means when I hit the limit really hard. So let's just go back here. Let's look at the small changes that are required to take this to an asynchronous web app. Well, that didn't seem to be much different, did it? This is the beauty of .NET 4.5. What's actually going on under the hood here is I'm creating a task and I'm chaining continuation tokens. And we can do this in .NET 4, but writing continuation and continuation token passing code is unbelievably error prone. In .NET 4.5, the compiler has added async and await, which says, I want to do this, and then I'm going to go away, and when something happens, please chain this work and this work and this work. This is what async and await does for you. It's the semantic sugar that creates this token passing chain. And you don't have to write it. So this is pretty good because now I'm saying that this operation is blocking, can take a while. But I've got to be async the whole way through. If I have one blocking operation in the chain, I haven't actually achieved anything. The good news is .NET 4.5, ADO.NET, now properly implements all of the async operators as well. So I can open a connection, that's blocking, so that's async, so we want to wait on that. Executing a command, that's async, that's a network-bound operation. And reading a data row is an async operation because that's network-bound. But once I've got the data, I don't need to create a task and pay the cost of a context switch and a dispatch just to get data out of a row I already have memory resident. So there's some muscles we need to build up in our developer community about what should be an async op, what shouldn't be, and where the balance is. And we'll get some more guidance out there. But in general, I wrote this code in probably about 20 minutes because I'd never actually done this before. Hey, I'm learning just a little bit ahead of you guys. Many of you are probably way ahead of me on this stuff. But it's finally accessible. It's sometimes a little getting the nuances of what's async, what passes a task, and whatnot. This can be a little weird, but the compiler at least tells you when you're brutally wrong. But now this code is fully asynchronous. If SQL is blocking, I'm not burning threads in my web server anymore. And that's just cool. That was all there was to it. But that wasn't quite enough. How many of you are working on applications where you have to receive data, not just publish data? Stupidly rhetorical question, everybody in the room, yeah. You know, it's kind of your cardio for the day. You have to put your hand up for stupid questions. So if I'm absorbing data, I can either take that data and write it synchronously, which is very, 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 very bad for the reasons we've already talked about. I can do it asynchronously, but that's still bad because of rate spikes. If I have designed my system to be able to write into that backing store 1,000 operations a second, and 10,000 users show up out of nowhere because of a spike to receive data, and I don't have a way to level, if I don't provide some way to do rate leveling, I'm going to have an outage. I'm going to have an availability event. My site's up, but it's not accepting work or delivering value. So the most common pattern here is I'm going to take the work, and I'm going to shovel it into a queue, and then I'm going to return to the user, I have your stuff, everything's fine, and I'll process it later. I'm trading latency for throughput because it's far easier to write into a queue than it is to write into a relational store. This is a good trade-off. If I need to provide even more rate leveling, I can write to multiple concurrent queues. If I need to be able to absorb spikes of 50,000 a second, I'll create 100 queues. They don't cost me anything if they're just sitting there. I'm only paying for the messages and the usage and the storage. So if I want to provision lots of resources, no cost, it's a metadata operation because under the hood it's just creating partitions in a table. So what this does, this very simple pattern of mediating, now I've split my web logic from my app logic because they're two physically distinct things now, mediated through a queue or a set of queues. The web servers are responsible for auth-z and auth-n. Who are you? Validation. Are you giving me good stuff? And I'm going to store this and process it later. This is classical batching. There's no new physics here. It's just the implementation approach. So let's actually walk through and have a look at what this code looks like. And I'll show you some how to make the storage 2.0 APIs not suck quite so much. Okay, so let's go to our... Well, as an aside, all of these samples will be published on Code Gallery in the next week or so. All right, so let's look at a little bit more robust web API. So in the web API world, controllers are created per request. So if I have anything that needs to be kind of a one-time initialized or an ongoing state, I need to create it and then make it available through the dependency injection container. And you can use Unity, you can use Spring, or any of the dependency injection containers out there. I just wrote a default one just for the purposes of the demo because I didn't want any more moving parts than necessary. So I've got some code that handles the queue, and I've got some code that handles the database access because I still have my gets. But now I have a put, and this is where things gets a little bit more interesting. So rather than returning a data type, I'm going to return a task of an HTTP response message because I'm making the choice to have more control over the response because there's more things that can happen and more things that can go wrong here. And I'm taking my data, I'm going to validate my data, I'm going to go back here and make this a little larger. It's because I'm getting old and my eyesight's going a little bit. And I'm going to take in some data, and all I'm going to do is do my validation, my conversion, and I say, hey, queue manager, add this data asynchronously to the backing queue, and then return an OK. Or if I throw an exception, I'm going to come back saying, something's not good. And all I'm doing in my queue manager, since that's an abstract, since that's an interface I'm writing against, I've got to go down here to my queue manager. So there's a bug in my code in that creating a queue if it does not exist is a blocking operation that if you do something like point it at your storage emulator and the storage emulator is not on, that can take 30 seconds. So what I should actually have here is a factory method that's running a private constructor and an initializer that is asynchronous and then returning that. This is bad code. I haven't had a chance to fix it. If you want, I can change it during the break and show you what it should look like. But in a world of asynchronous initialization, public constructors will need to go away and be replaced with factory methods because running a full initialized constructor is no longer, once you go outside of the boundaries of the process, you need to do that asynchronously. And the constructor and the compiler and the language assumes constructors just to be set a few local fields and go. So let's look at what adding a message does. So queues can take strings and byte arrays. So if I have a message, I need to put it into some format. I'm just going to use JSON. It's text. It's easy. It's relatively cheap. If I will never voluntarily have anything to do with XML ever again in my life. JSON does all of the stuff in a web and a devices world that XML purports to. It's faster and it's cheaper. I'm going to create a cloud queue message, which basically says wrap this content and then send it to a queue. And I'm using an add message async. So by default, the storage libraries have this begin add message and end add message. I'm being recorded, so I can't use the phrase I actually think of APM. But in general, begin message, add message is painful. However, .NET 4 with the tasks gives you a simple way of wrapping these. This is the pattern. You can use this everywhere. Basically, what I'm saying is I want a task completion source which ties begin to end and allows me to pass results. I call begin with my arguments, the result delegate, where I end the message, set the result, and I'm done. That's it. This allows me to wrap up all of the storage APM async calls in a nice task-based library that my developers will be used to using. And that's it. There we go. I've just enqueued the message. So I can absorb rate bursts very efficiently, shovel them off into queues. The other thing is, remember, so all of these systems, they're based on the operations per second, not the amount of work you put into each operation. So you want to be chunky, not chatty. If I want to insert data into SQL Server, I'm going to get a set number of transactions per second I can execute. So whether I send a single row or 100 rows or 1,000 rows, the number of ops is the same. Almost every system I've worked on that's basically ingesting data into SQL has bottlenecked on single row inserts. So if I want to do batch inserts, I either need to batch in memory, where I'm trading availability for throughput. If I lose the node, I lose the data. Or they push data into queues, pull them out in batches, push them into SQL, and then delete the items from the queue. It's the most efficient way to do things, and it's relatively simple because now the queue is responsible for holding onto the data. Just a little hint, if you folks are working on kind of bulk loading data into SQL, the magic number is 128. If you have less than 128 rows of data, use a table valued parameter. If you have above 128, use a SQL bulk copy or bulk insert. Little tidbit of information that may or may not be useful. And that comes back to the stateful versus stateless. A bulk insert is a stateful operation where I set up a bunch of scaffolding and then I put the fire hose on and turn on the fire hose. If I have a relatively small number of rows, aka less than 128, then it's just easier to throw it all into an array and shovel that at SQL. Okay. One last one. This is the other most common pattern I see dropping Azure services on the floor. I have a data set that I want to publish to a large number of consumers. This is incredibly common in mobile applications. Anything where this is a reference data set or a slow-changing data set. This can be stock quotes, this can be election results, this can be any data that I want to get out to a broad number of people. Or like, I don't know, conference schedules. And everybody knows where I went with that one. If I pull this data from disk every single time, this is a very poor use of electrons. I want to use my electrons efficiently. So what I want to do is I want to take the data that needs to be served out, pull it up into a distributed cache, which we'll talk about when we get to the second half of this one, and then serve it out from my web servers. This gives me the volatile in-memory data that I can serve very efficiently. If I can pull 1,000 records a second out of a SQL server, I can pull 50,000 a second out of a distributed cache. The cache is lower state, purely in memory, no external storage. It also has no query semantics, so I can only get at things by keys. This gets us more into that polyglot discussion. Again, this is the key pattern for any form of information publishing. Whether I'm doing read aloud, where if something's missing from the cache, I pull it directly, or if I have some for larger data sets that are sparse, where I may not need all of it in the cache at any point in time. But if I go back to the stock tick example, if I'm serving out 10,000 stock quotes, why wouldn't I keep them all in memory at the same time? What if it's 10 gigs? It's no big deal. It's not even all of an Excel machine. So memory is relatively cheap. If we need throughput, let's use it. And using it is relatively simple. So we'll just come down here to my final info publisher, and let's look at what the web role does. This looks almost exactly the same as the last one. You're going, well, Mark, you're just getting data from the database, aren't you? Not quite. So I'm basically doing a bit of an interceptor pattern here, where I now have implemented my cache data access layer, where for getting data. Yep. So here, what I'm doing is I'm just going out to my cache. I'm getting my data by key, and if it's not there, I get the data from the database, throw it in the cache, and then return. That's really all there is to it. Now again, this is a very simplistic sample. This just has one workflow with very basic data that doesn't have tightly interlaced schema. So of course, when implementing this in a production application with real workloads, it will be more complicated. But if you design these patterns in from the beginning, or you work at retrofitting your data access layer in a fairly, fairly layered fashion, you can take advantage of these things. So who's working on projects that leverage Entity Framework? Okay, so Entity Framework gets you many things, but you give up many things. It isolates you from the physical data model and gives you a more application-friendly data model. But it also puts a lot of layers between you and the electrons. This, in general, is good for agility, but it's bad for performance. So the common pattern we see is people who are heavily based around Entity Framework going, okay, for 90% of my queries, 90% of my data access, doesn't happen very often. I can pay the hit. But 10% of my queries are hot path. They're very important. So what I want to do is I want to extract those out of Entity Framework. and I want to go directly through an optimized ADO.NET channel directly. Again, because you're using Entity Framework or you're using ADO.NET, these are not binary choices. You can mix and match. Run into a few folks that favor kind of implementation purity, and I'm okay with that behind a common interface or a common layer, but don't get wedded to a specific implementation approach for kind of key data access. All right, quick recap. Understanding the core Azure platform capabilities, very important. These are the numbers you have to work with and design with. If you work with the platform, you can do fantastic things. If you work against it, it will run you down. And I can attest to that personally. Ignore the second bullet because we'll get to that a little bit later in terms of how I make these services communicate. Everything in Azure has a design target in terms of its throughput, not always in terms of its latency because different operations can take different amount of time, but there's always some form of design target that you design against. It can be a little bit conservative, but that's what we have to work with. It's not, can I get a bigger box? It's, can I get more little ones?
Additional videos in this series can be found on Channel 9 at http://channel9.msdn.com/series/failsafe. In addition, Microsoft Services and the Azure Customer Advisory Team have produced white papers and guidance on these subjects. You can find these on the Azure Architecture Center at http://www.windowsazure.com/en-us/develop/net/architecture.